spent a single day in the trenches Reds die in. Badges and medals glitter on his breast, a testament to things he's never done. He even wears a gilded sword, despite the many guards around him. The crown on his head is familiar, made of twisted red, gold, and black iron, each point a burst of curling flame. It seems to burn against his inky black hair, flecked with gray. How fitting, for the king is a burner, as was his father before him, and so on. Destructive, powerful controllers of heat and fire. Once, our kings used to burn dissenters with nothing more than a flaming touch. This king might not burn Reds anymore, but he still kills us with war and ruin. His name is one I've known since I was a little girl sitting in the schoolroom, still eager to learn as if it could get me somewhere. Tiberius Calor VI, King of Norta, Flame of the North. A mouthful if there ever was one. I would spit on his name if I could. The queen follows him, nodding at the crowd. Whereas the king's clothes are dark and severely cut, her navy and white garb is airy and light. She bows only to Samson's house, and I realize she's wearing the same colors as them. She must be their kin, judging by the family resemblance. Same ash-blonde hair, blue eyes, and pointed smile, making her look like a wild, predatory cat. As intimidating as the royals seem, they're nothing compared to the guards who follow them. Even though I'm a Red born in mud, I know who they are. Everyone knows what a sentinel looks like, because no one wants to meet them. They flank the king in every broadcast, at every speech or decree. As always, their uniforms look like flame, flickering between red and orange. And their eyes glitter behind fearsome black masks. Each one carries a black rifle, tipped with a gleaming silver bayonet that could cut bone. Their skills are even more frightening than their appearances. Elite warriors from different silver houses, trained from childhood, sworn to the king and his family for their entire lives. They're enough to make me shiver. But the high houses aren't afraid at all. Somewhere deep in the boxes, the yelling starts. "Death to the Scarlet Guard!" someone shouts. Then others quickly chime in. A chill goes through me as I remember the events of yesterday. Now so far away, how quickly this crowd could turn. The king looks ruffled, paling at the noise. He's not used to outbursts like this, and almost snarls at the shouts. "The Scarlet Guard and all our enemies are being dealt with!" Tiberius rumbles, his voice echoing out among the crowd. It silences them like the crack of a whip. "But that is not what we are here to address. Today we honor tradition, and no red devil will impede that. Now is the rite of Queen's Trial, to bring forth the most talented daughter to wed the most noble son. In this we find strength to bind the high houses and power to ensure silver rule until the end of days, to defeat our enemies on the borders and within them." "Strength," the crowd rumbles back at him. It's frightening. "Power. The time has come again to uphold this ideal, and both my sons honor our most solemn custom." He waves a hand, and two figures step forward, flanking their father. I cannot see their faces, but both are tall and black-haired, like the king. They too wear military uniforms. "The Prince Maven of House Calor and Mirandus, son of my royal wife, the Queen Ilara." The second prince, paler and slighter than the other, raises a hand in stern greeting. He turns left and right, and I catch a glimpse of his face. Though he has a regal, serious look to him, he can't be more than 17. Sharp-featured and blue-eyed, He could freeze fire with his smile. He despises this pageantry. I have to agree with him.
And the Crown Prince of House Kalor and Jaqos, son of my late wife, the Queen Corianne, heir to the kingdom of Norta and the burning crown, Tiberius the Seventh.
I'm too busy laughing at the sheer absurdity of the name to notice the young man waving and smiling. Finally, I raise my eyes, just to say I was this close to the future king. But I get much more than I bargained for. The glass goblets in my hands drop, landing harmlessly in the sink of water. I know that smile, and I know those eyes. They burned into mine only last night. He got me this job. He saved me from conscription. He was one of us. How can this be? And then he turns fully, waving all around. There's no mistaking it. The Crown Prince is Cal. 7. I return to the servants' platform, a hollow feeling in my stomach. Whatever happiness I felt before is completely gone. I can't bring myself to look back, to see him standing there in fine clothes, dripping with ribbons and medals and the royal airs I hate. Like Walsh, he bears the badge of the Flaming Crown, but his is made of dark jet, diamond, and ruby. It winks against the hard black of his uniform. Gone are the drab clothes he wore last night, used to blend in with peasants like me. Now he looks every inch a future king, silver to the bone. To think I trusted him. The other servants make way, letting me shuffle to the back of the line while my head spins. He got me this job. He saved me. Saved my family, and he is one of them. Worse than one of them, a prince! The prince! The person everyone in this spiral stone monstrosity is here to see.
All of you have come to honor my son and the kingdom, and so I honor you, King Tiberius booms, breaking apart my thoughts as if they were glass.
He raises his arms, gesturing to the many boxes of people. Though I try my hardest to keep my eyes on the king, I can't help but glance at Cal. He's smiling, but it doesn't reach his eyes.
I honor your right to rule. The future king, the son of my son, will be of your silver blood as he will be of mine. Who will claim their right?
The silver-haired patriarch barks out in response.
I claim Queen's Trial!
All over the spiral, the leaders of the different houses shout in unison,
I claim Queen's Trial!
They echo, upholding some tradition I don't understand. Tiberius smiles and nods.
Then it has begun! Lord Provost, if you would!
The king turns on the spot, looking toward what I assume is House Provost. The rest of the spiral follow his gaze, their eyes landing on a family dressed in gold striped with black. An older man, his gray hair shot with streaks of white, steps forward. In his strange clothes, he looks like a wasp about to sting. When he twitches his hand, I don't know what to expect. Suddenly, the platform lurches, moving sideways. I can't help but jump, almost knocking into the servant next to me, as we slide along an unseen track. My heart rises in my throat as I watch the rest of the spiral garden spin. Lord Provost is a Telki, moving the structure along pre-built tracks with nothing but the power of his mind. The entire structure twists under his command, until the garden floor widens into a huge circle. The lower terraces pull back, aligning with the upper levels, and the spiral becomes a massive cylinder open to the sky. As the terraces move, the floor lowers until it stops nearly 20 feet below the lowest box. The fountains turn into waterfalls, spilling from the top of the cylinder to the bottom, where they fill deep, narrow pools. Our platform glides to a stop above the king's box, allowing us a perfect view of everything, including the floor, far below. All this takes less than a minute, with Lord Provost transforming the spiral garden into something much more sinister. But when Provost takes his seat again, the change is still not done. The hum of electricity rises until it crackles all around, making the hairs on my arms stand up. A purple-white light blazes near the floor of the garden, sparking with energy from tiny unseen points in the stone. No silver stands up to command it, like Provost did with an arena. I realize why. This is not some silver's doing, but a wonder of technology, of electricity, lightning without thunder. The beams of light crisscross and intersect, weaving themselves into a brilliant, blinding net. Just looking at it hurts my eyes, sending sharp daggers of pain through my head. How the others can stand it, I have no idea. The silvers look impressed, intrigued with something they can't control. As for us reds, we gape in complete awe. The net crystallizes as the electricity expands and veins. And then, as suddenly as it came, the noise stops. The lightning freezes, solidifying in midair, creating a clear purple shield between the floor and us, between us and whatever might appear down there. My mind runs wild, wondering what could require a shield made of lightning. Not a bear or a pack of wolves or any of the rare beasts of the forest. Even the creatures of myth, great cats or sea sharks or dragons, would pose no harm to the many silvers above. And why would there be beasts at Queen's Trial? This is supposed to be a ceremony to choose queens, not fight monsters. As if answering me, the ground in the circle of statues, now the small center of the cylinder floor, opens wide. Without thinking, I push forward, hoping to get a better look with my own eyes. The rest of the servants crowd with me, trying to see what horrors this chamber can bring forth. The smallest girl I've ever seen rises out of darkness. Cheers rise as a house in brown silk and red gemstones applauds their daughter. "Roar of House Rhombos!" the family shouts, announcing her to the world. The girl, no more than 14, smiles up at her family. She's tiny in comparison to the statues, but her hands are strangely large. The rest of her looks liable to blow away in a strong breeze. She takes a turn about the ring of statues, always smiling upward. Her gaze lands on Cal, I mean the prince, trying to entice him with her doe eyes or the occasional flip of honey blonde hair. In short, she looks foolish, until she approaches a solid stone statue and sloughs its head off with a single, simple slap. House Rhombos speaks again. Strong arm! Below us, Little Roar destroys the floor in a whirlwind, turning statues into pulverized piles of dust while she cracks the ground beneath her feet. She's like an earthquake in tiny human form, breaking apart anything and everything in her way. So, this is a pageant. A violent one, meant to showcase a girl's beauty, splendor, and strength. The most talented daughter. This is a display of power, to pair the prince with the most powerful girl so that their children might be the strongest of all. And this has been going on for hundreds of years. I shudder to think of the strength in Cal's pinky finger. He claps politely as the Rhombos girl finishes her display of organized destruction and steps back onto the descending platform. House Rhombos cheers for her as she disappears. Next comes Heron of House Well, the daughter of my own governor. She's tall, with a face like her bird namesake. The destroyed earth shifts around her as she puts the floor back together. "Green Warden," her family chants. A greenie. At her command, trees grow tall in the blink of an eye, their tops scraping against the lightning shield. It sparks where the boughs touch, setting fire to the fresh leaves. The next girl, a nymph of House Osanos, rises to the occasion. Using the waterfall fountains, she douses the contained forest fire in a hurricane of white water, leaving only charred trees and scorched earth. This goes on for what feels like hours. Each girl rises up to show her worth, and each one finds a more destroyed arena. But they're trained to deal with anything. They range in age and appearance, but they are all dazzling. One girl, barely 12 years old, explodes everything she touches like some kind of walking bomb. "Oblivion!" her family shouts, describing her power. As she obliterates the last of the white statues, the lightning shield holds firm. It hisses against her fire, and the noise shrieks in my ears. The electricity, the silvers, and the shouts blur in my head as I watch nymphs and greenies, swifts, strongarms, telkies, and what seems like 100 other kinds of silver show off beneath the shield. Things I never dreamed possible happen before my eyes as girls turn their skin to stone or scream apart walls of glass. The silvers are greater and stronger than I ever feared, with powers I never even knew existed. How can these people be real? I've come all this way and suddenly I'm back in the arena, watching silvers display everything we are not. I want to marvel in awe as a creature controlling Animos calls down 1,000 doves from the sky. When birds dive headfirst into the lightning shield, bursting in little clouds of blood, feathers, and deadly electricity, my awe turns to disgust. The shield sparks again, burning up what's left of the birds until it shines like new. I almost retch at the sound of applause when the cold-blooded Animos sinks back into the floor. Another girl, hopefully the last, rises into an arena, now reduced to dust. "Evangeline of House Samos," yells the patriarch of the silver-haired family. He speaks alone, and his voice echoes across the spiral garden. From my vantage point, I notice the king and queen sit up a bit straighter. Evangeline already has their attention. In stark contrast, Cal looks down at his hands. While the other girls wore silk dresses, and a few had strange gilded armor, Evangeline rises in an outfit of black leather. Jacket, pants, boots. All studded with hard silver. No, not silver. Iron. Silver is not so dull or hard. Her house cheers for her, all of them on their feet. She belongs to Ptolemus and the Patriarch, but others cheer too. Other families. They want her to be queen. She is the favorite. She salutes, two fingers to her brow, first to her family and then to the king's box. They return the gesture, blatantly favoring this Evangeline. Maybe this is more like the feats than I realized. Except instead of showing the Reds where we stand, this is the king showing his subjects, powerful as they are, where they stand. A hierarchy within the hierarchy. I've been so preoccupied with the trials that I almost don't notice when it's my turn to serve again. Before anyone can nudge me in the right direction, I set off to the right box, barely hearing the Samos patriarch speak. Magnetron, I think he says, but I have no idea what it means. I move through the narrow corridors that were once open walkways, down to the silvers requiring service. The box is at the bottom, but I'm quick and take almost no time getting down to them. I find a particularly fat clan, dressed in garish yellow silk and awful feathers, all enjoying a massive cake. Plates and empty cups litter the box, and I get to work cleaning them up, my hands quick and practiced. A video screen blares inside the box, displaying Evangeline, who seems to be standing still down on the floor. "What a farce this is!" one of the fat yellow birds grumbles as he stuffs his face. "The Samos girl has already won!" Strange, she seems to be the weakest of all. I pile the plates but keep my eyes on the screen, watching her prowl across the wasted floor. It doesn't seem like there's anything for her to work with, to show what she can do, but she doesn't seem to mind. Her smirk is terrible, like she's totally convinced of her own magnificence. She doesn't look magnificent to me. Then the iron studs on her jacket move. They float in the air, each one a hard, round bullet of metal. Then, like shots from a gun, they rocket away from Evangeline, digging into the dust and the walls and even the lightning shield. She can control metal. Several boxes applaud for her, but she's far from finished. Groans and clanks echo up to us from somewhere deep down in the structural of the spiral garden. Even the fat family stops eating to look around, perplexed. They are confused and intrigued, but I can feel the vibrations deep beneath my feet. I know to be afraid. With an earth-shattering noise, metal pipes splinter the floor of the arena, rising up from far below. They burst through the walls, surrounding Evangeline in a twisted crown of gray and silver metal. She looks like she's laughing, but the deafening crunch of metal drowns her out. Sparks fall from the lightning shield, and she protects herself with scrap, not even breaking a sweat. Finally, she lets the metal drop with a horrible smash. She turns her eyes skyward to the boxes above. Her mouth is open wide, showing sharp little teeth. She looks hungry. It starts slowly, a slight change in balance, until the whole box lurches. Plates crash to the floor, and glass cups roll forward, tumbling over the rail to shatter on the lightning shield. Evangeline is pulling our box out, bending it forward, making us tip. The silvers around me squawk and scrabble, their applause turning to panic. They're not the only ones. Every box in our row moves with us. Far below, Evangeline directs with a hand, her brow furrowed in focus. Like silver fighters in the ring, she wants to show the world what she's made of. That is the thought in my head as a yellow ball of skin and feathered clothing knocks into me, pitching me over the rail with the rest of the silverware. All I see is purple as I fall, the lightning shield rising up to meet me. It hisses with electricity, singeing the air. I barely have time to understand, but I know the veined purple glass will cook me alive, electrocuting me in my red uniform. I bet the silvers will only care about waiting for someone to clean me off. My head bangs against the shield, and I see stars. No, not stars. Sparks. The shield does its job, lighting me up with bolts of electricity. My uniform burns, scorched and smoking, and I expect to see my skin do the same. My corpse will smell wonderful, but somehow I don't feel a thing. I must be in so much pain that I cannot feel it. But I can feel it. I feel the heat of the sparks running up and down my body, setting every nerve on fire. It isn't a bad feeling, though. In fact, I feel, well, alive. Like I've been living my whole life blind, and now I've opened my eyes. Something moves beneath my skin, but it's not the sparks. I look at my hands, my arms, marveling at the lightning as it glides over me. Cloth burns away, charred black by the heat, but my skin doesn't change. The shield keeps trying to kill me, but it can't. Everything is wrong. I am alive. The shield gives off a black smoke, starting to splinter and crack. The sparks are brighter, angrier, but weakening. I try to push myself up, to get to my feet, but the shield shatters beneath me and I fall again, tumbling over myself. Somehow I manage to land in a pile of dust, not covered by jagged metal, definitely bruised and weak in the muscles, but still in one piece. My uniform is not so lucky, barely holding together in a charred mess. I struggle to my feet, feeling more of my uniform flake off. Above us, murmurs and gasps echo through the spiral garden. I can feel all eyes on me, the burned red girl, the human lightning rod. Evangeline stares at me, her eyes wide. She looks angry, confused, and scared. of me. Somehow she is scared of me. Hi, I say, stupidly. Evangeline answers with a flurry of metal shards, all of them sharp and deadly, pointed at my heart as they rip through the air. Without thinking, I throw up my hands, hoping to save myself from the worst of it. Instead of catching a dozen jagged blades in my palms, I feel something quite different. Like with the sparks before, my nerves sing, alive with some inner fire. It moves in me, behind my eyes, beneath my skin, until I feel more than myself. Then it bursts from me, pure power and energy. A jet of light, no, lightning, erupts from my hands, blazing through the metal. The pieces shriek and smoke, bursting apart in the heat. They fall harmlessly to the ground as the lightning blasts into the far wall. It leaves a smoking hole 4 feet wide, barely missing Evangeline. Her mouth falls open in shock. I'm sure I look the same as I stare at my hands, wondering what on earth just happened to me. High above, 100 of the most powerful silvers wonder the same thing. I look up to see them all peering at me. Even the king leans over the edge of his box, his flaming crown silhouetted against the sky. Cal is right next to him, staring down at me with wide eyes. Sentinels! The king's voice is sharp as a razor, full of menace. Suddenly, the red-orange uniforms of sentinels blaze from almost every box. The elite guards wait for another word, another order. I'm a good thief because I know when to run. Now is one of those times. Before the king can speak, I bolt, pushing past the stunned Evangeline to slide feet first into the still open hatch in the floor. Seize her! Echoes behind me as I drop into the semi-darkness of the chamber below. Evangeline's flying metal show punched holes in the ceiling, and I can still see up into the spiral garden. To my dismay, it looks like the structure is bleeding, as uniformed sentinels drop down from their boxes, all of them racing after me. With no time to think, all I can do is run. The antechamber below the arena connects to a dark and empty hallway. Boxy black cameras watch me as I run at full speed, turning down another corridor and another. I can feel them, hunting like the sentinels not so far behind me. Run, repeats in my head. Run, run, run. I have to find a door, a window, something to help me get my bearings. If I can get outside, into the market maybe, I might have a chance, I might. The first set of stairs I find leads up to a long, mirrored hall. But the cameras are there as well, sitting in the corners of the ceiling like great black bugs. A blast of gunfire explodes over my head, forcing me to drop to the floor. Two sentinels, their uniforms the color of fire, crash through a mirror and charge at me. They're just like security, I tell myself. Just bumbling officers who don't know you. They don't know what you can do. I don't know what I can do. They expect me to run. So I do the opposite, storming the pair of them. Their guns are big and powerful, but bulky. Before they can get them up to shoot, stab, or both, I drop to my knees on the smooth marble floor, sliding between the two giants. One of them shouts after me, his voice exploding another mirror in a storm of glass. By the time they manage to change directions, I'm already off and running again. When I finally find a window, it's a blessing and a curse. I skid to a stop in front of a giant pane of diamond glass, looking out to the vast forest. It's right there, just on the other side, just beyond an impenetrable wall. All right, hands, now might be a good time to do your thing. Nothing happens, of course. Nothing happens when I need it to. A blaze of heat takes me by surprise. I turn to see an approaching wall of red and orange, and I know the sentinels have found me. But the wall is hot, flickering, almost solid. Fire. And coming right at me. My voice is faint, weak, defeated, as I laugh at my predicament. Oh, great. I turn to run, but instead collide with a broad wall of black fabric. Strong arms wrap around me, holding me still when I try to squirm away. Shock him! Light him up! I scream in my head. But nothing happens. The miracle isn't going to save me again. The heat grows, threatening to crush the air from my lungs. I survived lightning today. I don't want to press my luck with fire. But it's the smoke that's going to kill me. Thick and black and much too strong, choking me. My vision swirls, and my eyelids grow heavy. I hear footsteps, shouting, the roar of fire as the world darkens. I'm sorry, Cal's voice says. I think I'm dreaming. 8. I'm on the porch, watching as Mom says goodbye to my brother Bree. She weeps, holding on to him tightly, smoothing his freshly cut hair. Shade and Trammy wait to catch her if her legs fail. I know they want to cry, too, watching their oldest brother go. But for Mom's sake, they don't. Next to me, Dad says nothing, content to stare at the Legionnaire. Even in his armor of steel plate and bulletproof fabric, the soldier looks small next to my brother. Bree could eat him alive, but he doesn't. He doesn't do anything at all when the Legionnaire grabs his arm, pulling him away from us. The shadow follows, haunting after him on terrible dark wings. The world spins around me, and then I'm falling. I land a year later, my feet stuck in the squelching mud beneath our house. Now Mom holds on to Trammy, begging with the Legionnaire. Shade has to pull her off. Somewhere, Gisa cries for her favorite brother. Dad and I keep silent, saving our tears. The shadow returns, this time swirling around me, blotting out the sky and the sun. I squeeze my eyes shut, hoping it will leave me alone. When I open them again, I'm in Shade's arms, hugging him as tightly as I can. He hasn't cut his hair yet, and his chin-length brown hair tickles the top of my head. As I press myself to his chest, I wince. My ear stings sharply, and I pull back, seeing drops of red blood on my brother's shirt. Gisa and I had pierced our ears again, with the tiny gift Shade left us. I guess I did it wrong, as I do everything wrong. This time, I feel the shadow before I see it, and it feels angry. It drags me through a parade of memories, all raw wounds still healing. Some of them are even dreams. No, they are nightmares. My worst nightmares. A new world materializes around me, forming a shadowed landscape of smoke and ash. The choke. I've never been there, but I've heard enough to imagine it. The land is flat, pocked with craters from 1,000 falling bombs. Soldiers in stained red uniforms cower in each of them, like blood filling a wound. I float through them all, searching the faces, looking for the brothers I lost to smoke and shrapnel. Bree appears first, wrestling with a blue-clad Lakelander in a puddle of mud. I want to help him, but I keep floating until he's out of sight. Trammy comes next, bending over a wounded soldier, trying to keep him from bleeding to death. His gentle features, so like Gisa's, are twisted in agony. I will never forget the screams of pain and frustration. As with Bree, I can't help him. Shade waits at the front of the line, beyond even the bravest of warriors. He stands on top of a ridge without regard for the bombs or the guns or the Lakelander army waiting on the other side. He even has the gall to smile at me. I can only watch when the ground beneath his feet explodes, destroying him in a plume of fire and ash. Stop! I manage to scream, reaching for the smoke that was once my brother. The ash takes shape, reforming into the shadow. It engulfs me in darkness until a wave of memories overtakes me again. Gisa's hand, Killorn's conscription, Dad coming home half-dead. They blur together, a swirl of too bright color that hurts my eyes. Something is not right. The memories move backward through the years, like I'm watching my life in reverse. And then there are events I can't possibly remember. Learning to speak, to walk, my child brothers passing me between them while Mom scolds. This is impossible. Impossible, the shadow says to me. The voice is so sharp, I fear it might crack my skull. I fall to my knees, colliding with what feels like concrete. And then, they're gone. My brothers, my parents, my sister, my memories, my nightmares, gone. Concrete and steel bars rise around me. A cage. I struggle to my feet, one hand on my aching head, as things come into focus. A figure stares at me from beyond the bars. A crown glitters on her head. I bow, but I might fall over, I say to Queen Alara, and immediately I wish I could call back the words. She's a silver. I can't talk to her that way. She could put me in the stocks, take away my rations, punish me, punish my family. No, I realize in my growing horror, she's the queen. She could just kill me. She could kill us all. But she doesn't look offended. Instead, she smirks. A wave of nausea washes over me when I meet her eyes, then I double over again. That looks like a bow to me, she purrs, enjoying my pain. I fight the urge to vomit and reach out to grab the bars. My fist clenches around cold steel. What are you doing to me? Not much of anything anymore, but this. She reaches through the bars to touch my temple. The pain triples beneath her finger, and I fall against the bars, barely conscious enough to hold on. This is to keep you from doing anything silly. Tears sting my eyes, but I shake them away. Like stand on my own two feet? I manage to spit out. I can hardly think through the pain, let alone be polite, but still I manage to hold back a stream of curses. For heaven's sake, Mare Barrow, hold your tongue. Like electrocute something, she snaps. The pain ebbs, giving me enough strength to make it to the metal bench. When I rest my head against the cool stone wall, her words sink in. Electrocute. The memory flashes across my mind, coming back in jagged pieces. Evangeline, the lightning shield, the sparks, and me. It's not possible. You are not silver. Your parents are red. You are red, and your blood is red, the queen murmurs, prowling before the bars of my cage. You are a miracle, Mare Barrow, an impossibility, something even I can't understand, and I have seen all of you. That was you? I almost screech, reaching up to cradle my head again. You were in my mind? My memories? My nightmares? If you know someone's fear, you know them. She blinks at me like I'm some stupid creature. And I had to know what it is we're dealing with. I am not an it. What you are remains to be seen. But be thankful for one thing, little lightning girl. She sneers, putting her face against the bars. Suddenly, my legs seize up, losing all feeling like I sat on them wrong, like I'm paralyzed. Panic rises in my chest as I realize I can't even wiggle my toes. This must be how Dad feels, broken and useless. But somehow I get to my feet, my legs moving on their own, marching me toward the bars. On the other side, the queen watches me. Her blinks match my steps. She's a whisper, and she's playing with me. When I'm close enough, she grabs my face in her hands. I cry out as the pain in my head multiplies. What I would give now for the simple doom of conscription. You did that in front of hundreds of silvers. People who will ask questions. People with power. She hisses in my ear, her sickly sweet breath washing over my face. That is the only reason you are still alive. My hands clench, and I wish for the lightning again. But it doesn't come. She knows what I'm doing and laughs openly. Stars explode behind my eyes, clouding my vision, but I hear her go in a swirl of rustling silk. My sight returns just in time to see her dress disappear around a corner. leaving me well and truly alone in the cell. I barely make it back to the bench, fighting the urge to throw up. Exhaustion comes over me in waves, starting in my muscles and sinking into my bones. I am only human, and humans are not supposed to deal with days like today. With a jolt, I realize my wrist is bare. The red band is gone, taken away. What could that mean? Tears sting my eyes, threatening to fall, but I will not cry. I have that much pride left. I can fight the tears, but not the questions, not the doubt growing in my heart. What's happening to me? What am I? I open my eyes to see a security officer staring at me from the other side of the bars. His silver buttons shine in the low light, but they're nothing compared to the glare bouncing off his bald head. "You have to tell my family where I am," I blurt out, sitting straight up. At least I said I loved them, I remember, thinking back to our last moments. "I don't have to do anything but take you upstairs," he replies, but without much bite. The officer is a pillar of calm. "Change your clothes." Suddenly, I realize I still have a half-burned uniform hanging off me. The officer points at a neat pile of clothes near the bars. He turns his back, allowing me some semblance of privacy. The clothes are plain but fine, softer than anything I've ever worn before. A long-sleeved white shirt and black pants, both of them decorated with a single silver stripe down each side. There are shoes as well, black oiled boots that rise to my knees. To my surprise, there isn't a stitch of red on the clothes. But why, I do not know. My ignorance is becoming a theme. "All right," I grumble, fighting the last boot up my leg. As it slides into place, the officer turns around. I don't hear the jingle of keys, but then I don't see a lock. How he plans to let me out of my doorless cage, I'm not sure. But instead of opening some hidden gate, his hand twitches and the metal bars bow open. Of course, the jailer would be a magnetron, yes, he says with a waggle of his fingers. "In case you were wondering, the girl you nearly fried is a cousin." I almost choke on the air in my lungs, not knowing how to respond. "I'm sorry?" It sounds like a question. "He's sorry you missed her," he replies without a hint of jest. "Evangeline is a bitch." "Family trait?" My mouth moves faster than my brain, and I gasp, realizing what I've just said. He doesn't strike me for speaking out of turn, though he has every right to. Instead, the officer's face twitches into the shadow of a smile. "I guess you'll find out," he says, black eyes soft. "I'm Lucas Samos. Follow me." I don't have to ask to know I have no other choice in the matter. He leads me out of my cell and up a winding stair to no less than 12 security officers. Without a word, they surround me in a well-practiced formation and force me along with them. Lucas stays by me, marching in time with the others. They keep their guns in hand, as if ready for battle. Something tells me the men aren't here to defend me, but to protect everyone else. When we reach the more beautiful upper levels, the glass walls are strangely black. Tinted, I tell myself, remembering what Giza said about the Hall of the Sun. The diamond glass can darken on command to hide what shouldn't be seen. Obviously, I must fall into that category. With a jolt, I realize that the windows change not because of some mechanism, but a red-haired officer. She waves a hand at every wall we pass, and some power within her blocks out the light, clouding the glass with thin shade. "She's a shadow, a bender of light," Lucas whispers, noting my awe. The cameras are here as well. My skin crawls, feeling their electric gaze running over my bones. Normally my head would ache under the weight of so much electricity, but the pain never comes. Something in the shield has changed me, or maybe it released something, revealing a part of myself locked away for so long. "What am I?" echoes in my head again, more threatening than before. Only when we pass through a monstrous set of doors does the electric sensation pass. The eyes cannot see me here. The chamber inside could encompass my house 10 times, stilts and all. And directly across from me, his fiery gaze burning into mine, is the king, sitting on a diamond glass throne carved into an inferno. Behind him, a window full of daylight quickly fades to black. It might be the last glimpse of sun I'll ever see. Lucas and the other officers march me forward, but they don't stay long. With nothing but a backward glance, Lucas leads the others out. The king sits before me, the queen standing on his left, the princes on his right. I refuse to look at Cal, but I know he must be gawking at me. I keep my gaze on my new boots, focusing on my toes so I don't give over to the fear turning my body to lead. "You will kneel," the queen murmurs, her voice soft as velvet. I should kneel, but my pride won't let me. Even here, in front of Silvers, in front of the king, my knees do not bend. "I will not," I say, finding the strength to look up. "Do you enjoy your cell, girl?" Tiberius says, his kingly voice filling the room. The threat in his words is plain as day, but still I stand. He cocks his head, staring at me like I'm an experiment to puzzle over. "What do you want with me?" I manage to force out. The queen leans down next to him. "I told you, she's red, through and through." But the king waves her off, like he would a fly. She purses her lips and draws back, hands clasped tightly together. Serves her right.
"What I want concerning you is impossible," Tiberius snaps.
His glare smolders, like he's trying to burn me up. I remember the queen's words.
"Well, I'm not sorry you can't kill me."
The king chuckles.
"They didn't say you were quick."
Relief floods through me. Death does not wait for me here. Not yet. The king throws down a stack of papers, all of them covered in writing. The top sheet has the usual information, including my name, birth date, parents, and the little brown smear that is my blood. My picture is there, too, the one on my identification card. I stare down at myself, into bored eyes, sick of waiting in line to have my picture taken. How I wish I could jump into the photo, into the girl whose only problems were conscription and a hungry belly.
"Mayor Molly Barrow, born November 17th, 302 of the New Era, to Daniel and Ruth Barrow,"
Tiberius recites from memory, laying my life bare.
"You have no occupation and are scheduled for conscription on your next birthday. You attend school sparingly, your academic test scores are low, and you have a list of offenses that would land you in prison in most cities. Thievery, smuggling, resisting arrest, to name but a few. Altogether, you are poor, rude, immoral, unintelligent, impoverished, bitter, stubborn, and a blight upon your village and my kingdom."
The shock of his blunt words takes a moment to sink in. But when it does, I don't argue. He's entirely right.
"And yet," he continues, rising to his feet.
This close, I can see his crown is deathly sharp. The points can kill.
"You are also something else. Something I cannot fathom. You are red and silver both. A peculiarity with deadly consequences you cannot understand. So what am I to do with you?"
Is he asking me?
"You could let me go. I wouldn't say a word."
The queen's sharp laughter cuts me off.
"And what about the high houses? Will they keep silent as well? Will they forget the little lightning girl in a red uniform?"
"No. No one will."
"You know my advice, Tiberius," the queen adds, her eyes on the king, "and it will solve both our problems."
It must be bad advice, bad for me, because Cal clenches a fist. The movement draws my eye, and I finally look at him fully. He remains still, stoic and quiet, as I'm sure he's been trained to do, but fire burns behind his eyes.
For a moment he meets my gaze, but I look away before I can call out and ask him to save me.
Yes, Ilara, the king says, nodding at his wife. We cannot kill you, Mare Barrow.
Not yet, hangs in the air.
So we are going to hide you in plain sight, where we can watch you, protect you, and attempt to understand you.
The way his eyes gleam makes me feel like a meal about to be devoured.
Father!
The word bursts from Cal, but his brother, the paler, leaner prince, grabs him by the arm, holding him back from protesting further. He has a calming effect, and Cal steps back in line. Tiberius goes on, ignoring his son.
You are no longer Mare Barrow, a red daughter of the Stilts.
Then who am I? I ask, my voice shaking with dread, thinking of all the awful things they can do to me.
Your father was Ethan Titanos, general of the Iron Legion, killed when you were an infant. A soldier, a red man, took you for his own and raised you in the dirt, never telling you your true parentage. You grew up believing you were nothing, and now, thanks to chance, you are made whole again. You are Silver, a lady of a lost high house, a noble with great power, and one day, a princess of Norta.
Try as I might, I can't hold back a surprised yelp.
A Silver? A princess?
My eyes betray me, flying to Cal. A princess must marry a prince.
You will marry my son, Maven, and you'll do it without putting a toe out of line.
I swear I hear my jaw hit the floor. A wretched, embarrassing sound escapes my mouth as I search for something to say. But I'm honestly speechless. In front of me, the younger prince looks equally confused, sputtering just as loudly as I want to. This time, it's Cal's turn to restrain him, though his eyes are on me. The young prince manages to find his voice.
I don't understand, he blurts out, shrugging off Cal.
He takes quick steps towards his father.
She's... why?
Usually I'd be offended, but I have to agree with the prince's reservations.
Quiet, his mother snaps. You will obey.
He glares at her, every inch the young son rebelling against his parents. But his mother hardens, and the prince backs down, knowing her wrath and power as well as I do. My voice is faint, barely audible. This seems a bit much. There's simply no other way to describe it. You don't want to make me a lady, much less a princess. Tiberius's face cracks into a grim smile. Like the queen, his teeth are blindingly white.
Oh, but I do, my dear. For the first time in your rudimentary little life, you have a purpose.
The jab feels like a slap across the face.
Here we are, in the early stages of a badly timed rebellion, with terrorist groups or freedom fighters or whatever the hell these idiotic red fools call themselves, blowing things up in the name of equality.
The Scarlet Guard. Farley. Shade. As soon as the name crosses my mind, I pray Queen Ilara stays out of my head.
They bombed the capital.
Yes. The king shrugs, scratching his neck. My years in the shadows have taught me many things. Who carries the most money? Who won't notice you? And what liars look like. The king is a liar, I realize, watching as he forces another shrug. He's trying to be dismissive, and it's just not working. Something has him scared of Farley, of the Scarlet Guard. Something much bigger than a few explosions.
And you, he continues, leaning forward, you might be able to help us stop there from being any more.
I'd laugh out loud if I wasn't so scared.
By marrying...
sorry, what's your name again? His cheeks go white, in what I assume is the silver version of a blush. After all, their blood is silver. My name is Maven, he says, his voice soft and quiet. Like Cal and his father, his hair is glossy black,
but the similarities end there. While they are broad and muscled, Maven is lean, with eyes like clear water. And I still don't understand. What Father is trying to say is that she represents an opportunity for us, Cal says, cutting in to explain. Unlike his brother, Cal's voice is strong and authoritative. It's the voice of a king. The Reds see her, a silver by blood but red by nature, raised up with us. They can be placated. It's like an old fairy tale. Commoner becoming the princess. She's their champion. They can look to her instead of terrorists. And then, softer, but more important than anything else, she's a distraction. But this isn't a fairy tale or even a dream. This is a nightmare. I'm being locked away for the rest of my life, forced into being someone else, into being one of them, a puppet, a show to keep people happy, quiet, and trampled. And, if we get the story right, the High Houses will be satisfied, too. You're the lost daughter of a war hero. What better honor can we give you? I meet his eyes, silently pleading. He helped me once. Maybe he can do it again. But Cal tips his head from side to side, shaking his head, slowly. He can't help me here. This isn't a request, Lady Titanos, Tiberius says. He uses my new name, my new title. You will go through with this, and you will do it properly. Queen Alara turns her pale eyes on me. You will live here, as is the custom for royal brides. Every day will be scheduled at my discretion, and you will be tutored in everything and anything possible to make you... She searches for the word, chewing on her lip. Suitable. I don't want to know what that means. You will be scrutinized. From now on, you live on the edge of a knife. One false step, one wrong word, and you will suffer for it. My throat tightens. Like I can feel the chains the king and queen are wrapping around me. What about my life? What life? Ilara crows. Girl, you have fallen head over heels into a miracle. Cal squeezes his eyes shut for a moment, as if the sound of the queen's laughter pains him. She means her family. Mare, the girl, has a family. Gisa, Mom, Dad. The boys, Killorn, a life taken away. Oh, that, the king huffs, plopping back down into his chair. I suppose we'll give them an allowance, keep them quiet. I want my brothers brought home from the war. For once, I feel like I've said something right. And my friend, Killorn Warren, don't let the legions take him either. Tiberius responds in half a heartbeat. A few red soldiers mean nothing to him. Done. It sounds less like a pardon and more like a death sentence. 9. Lady Marina Titanos, born to Lady Nora Noel Titanos and Lord Ethan Titanos, General of the Iron Legion, heiress to House Titanos, Marina Titanos. Titanos. My new name echoes in my head as the Red Maids prepare me for the coming onslaught. The three girls work quickly and efficiently, never speaking to one another. They don't ask me questions either, even though they must want to. Say nothing, I remember. They're not allowed to speak to me, and they certainly aren't allowed to talk about me to anyone else. Even the strange things, the red things, I'm sure they see. Over many agonizing minutes, they try to make me suitable, bathing me, styling me, painting me into the silly thing I'm supposed to be. The makeup is the worst, especially the thick white paste applied to my skin. They go through 3 pots of it, covering my face, neck, collarbone, and arms with a glittery wet powder. In the mirror, it looks like the warmth is leached from me, as if the powder has covered the heat in my skin. With a gasp, I realize it's supposed to hide my natural flush, the red bloom in my skin, the red blood. I'm pretending to be silver. And when they finish painting my face,
I actually look the part. With my newly pale skin and dark